This coming Thursday, June 14th, the Los Angeles Independent Media Center, in solidarity with the people of Oaxaca and Mal de Ojo TV, will present the documentary True to My Pledge, Compromiso Cumplido. True to My Pledge is a documentary about human rights violations that have taken place during the current conflict in Oaxaca. The first public screening of True to My Pledge takes place this Thursday, June 14th, at 7:30 p.m. at the Sabor y Cultura Cafe at 5625 Hollywood Boulevard. That's at the corner of Hollywood and Gramercy. For more information, visit the LA Indie Media website. You can find a link to the site on the Indie Media On Air page at kpfk.org. You're listening to an interview with Molefi Ndlovu, radical community radio activist in Soweto, South Africa. He's interviewed by Sakari Akine of Pambazuka News.
It's a fascinating project, and if you wanted to start again, how would you go about it? What lessons have you actually learned? Because it seems like you were, to use the word, victim of your own success. You were so successful without having planned to be successful, and also in a very short period of time. So, you know, rather than say community radio in Soweto is dead, I would say that it's on hold. So how would you next time go about sustaining this community radio without a license? Because I understand getting a license is very, very difficult.
Because the way that we see it, we don't see this argument for community radio station existing in an island. I think for me, Rasa FM is still very much alive insofar as the collective is dispersed all over the place, but we still have that identity about us. And because we had experienced that it works, there's still a belief in us that, you know, we need to set it up. But I think the major lesson that we would have taken from the first attempt, at least, was the fact that we needed to think out more thoroughly what our arguments are around free, low-power radio stations at the community level. There's not enough thinking, especially at policy side and things like that. But also, we also needed to do quite a bit at connecting the radio station so that it's not only about the radio, so that it's more integrated with some other things that people are doing. So the radio station, for it to, at least for the type of project that it wants to be, the social challenge that it wants to pose, for it to survive, it cannot do that on its own as just a radio station of curious people, because then it can be, you know, diminished and all these interests are working against it. So I think the major thing then is to, okay, I've said the first is to interrogate further and expand our argument for legal framework to be built for low power radio station, but further that we articulate the concept of community media in all organizational forms, in most of the community organizations. So we integrate not only the radio station with the mic, but the skills of writing a story, of telling stories differently, the ways that we get people involved in producing some of these stories, building a certain sense of activist ethic in journalism that I think is missing in most community initiatives. That could work two functions. It could work to build a much stronger project in terms of future viability, but it could also work to strengthen the democratic processes in organizations at community level, where ordinary people themselves become also protagonists in the telling of their stories. It could also break down the barriers of who is in possession of knowledge and who is supposed to be, you know, receiving the knowledge, you know. And so somehow I think for my perception, I think the success of social movement activism and so on is also very heavily reliable on its ability to be self-reliant in creating philosophies and theories of practice that can be expressed by the most, even the lowly of the people that are part of it, as well as those that consider themselves as experts, you know, the breakdown of those barriers. And I think Yeah, that's the effort we still arguing, at least as in the media, South Africa, that is still very much in our program, to go out now. We've tested it. It has worked. It's not about the technology. It's not about people's willingness to participate. It's about, you know, the practical application of it, resource-wise, as well as legally, or, you know, the security of people, so that they don't feel like they're committing a crime by taking a microphone or by entering the airwaves. We need to make it an argument even amongst our activists and so on, to say that the airwaves are ours.
Yeah, it's about people basically having the right to speak. It's about freedom of expression and breaking down those barriers, because what has happened in this instance is that your right to speak has been silenced, or has been attempted to be silenced. And I think that is the main issue with community radio on this level.
Yeah, and community radio, I must tell you, is the, for me, I think it's the most accessible means through which anyone that has got a voice, that has got a set of experiences, that has got something to say, can enter into. All they need to do is to have a microphone and express it. It overcomes the limitations of illiteracy that a lot of people have complained that, you know, we're not able to create newsletters at community level because people can't write. At a radio, people can just speak from where they are at. You build also a consciousness of community by just creating the space for like-minded people to share and express their interests in an open space that they can dial onto. So not only the community in the physical, but the community at a bigger level, because, I mean, the potentials for radio are also expansive, because you can link it to the internet and you can have not only a geographically determined community.
Yeah, but you see, the problem, Molefe, is that what you're talking about, which I completely agree with everything you say, is that this is very subversive. You have community radio, you have people with voices. It becomes a very powerful movement as the community grows, and as you say, you connect to the internet and it becomes larger and larger. Maybe you connect up with communities everywhere. For the establishment, this is very dangerous and very subversive.
That's why I say you cannot imagine this project outside of transformative project of transforming the social relations of power. And media is another way that is a lever of power in society. And of course, Vele, it won't be wholeheartedly embraced, because it would undermine, you know, dominance of commerce and all of that in the, you know, the spaces that, you know, occupy the radio and all of that. But it's a project that, if we are real about making sure that democracy and making sure that people have a substantial and meaningful role to play in a society, then it's one of the things, fundamental cornerstones by which we build a transformative project that doesn't only want to create things at the immediate level, but wants to build for the future, yeah, build other pools of knowledge that others can also follow and even improve on. And it's also a way that, for instance, in Africa, we can link up with brothers in Zimbabwe. I know that while we were operating the radio station in Soweto, I helped set up another two radio stations in Tanzania, one in Dar es Salaam and one in Arusha. And one radio station had been set up in Kenya during the WSF, and another is in the process of being set up in Harare, Zimbabwe. And I mean, all of these nets, they are very isolated at the moment, they are sparse and so on, but the argument is essentially the same, that, you know, not only is it us controlling the power of our real lived experience, also our symbolic and representative spaces, the way that we are reflected, need to also be taken up by the hand. It's not going to be easy, and it's probably going to be quite a challenge, and a lot of us may fall all along the way, but we need to start it.
Okay, thank you very much, Molefe. It's been really nice talking to you.
There's more fire. 104.5, we mic what we live. Yes!
For more information on Indymedia, go to their website, which is southafrica.indymedia.org. Thank you.
That was radical community radio activist Molefe Ndlovu of Soweto, South Africa, speaking to Sakari Akine of Pambazuka News. To learn more about social justice movements throughout Africa, told from an African point of view, go to the KPFK website, click on Programs, then choose Indie Media On Air. There, you'll find links to the Pambazuka News website and other resources, including the musicians you heard in this segment. This is Indie Media On Air on KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara. When the Cold War officially ended in 1991, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists moved the doomsday clock back to 17 minutes before midnight, saying that, quote, "The illusion that tens of thousands of nuclear weapons are a guarantor of national security has been stripped away." In 2002, they moved the clock back to 7 minutes before midnight, and in January this year, the clock was moved even closer to doomsday. It's 5 minutes to midnight, and the bulletin states, "The world stands at the brink of a second nuclear age." In the next segment, Red Eye Co-op radio reporter Karen McIntosh talks to Dr. Joseph Gerson, Director of Programs and Director of the Peace and Economic Security Program for the American Friends Service Committee in New England. He's also the author of the new book, Empire and the Bomb.
Empire and the Bomb, How the U.S. Uses Nuclear Weapons to Dominate the World, is a history of U.S. imperial ambitions and its use of nuclear weapons since World War II. Dr. Joseph Gerson is the author of Empire and the Bomb. He's the Director of Programs of the American Friends Service Committee in New England and a leading figure in the U.S. peace movement. Joseph Gerson joins me now by phone from his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hello, Joseph.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. In your book, you discuss the U.S. rationale for and the impact of the first nuclear terrorism, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Why did the American government drop atomic bombs on Japanese cities in 1945?
Well, as early as 1943, the United States understood that Germany wouldn't get a bomb, which was the ostensible reason for the beginning of the U.S. nuclear program. And it was clear as early as 1943 that the bomb was about the Soviet Union. There were multiple reasons, in part also having to do with President Truman's reelection campaign, which would be coming in 1948. But the determining reasons had to do with bringing the war to an immediate halt so the United States wouldn't have to share influence in Asia, in northern China, Manchuria, Korea, as it had to do in Europe at the end of the Second World War. And secondly, to terrorize the Soviet Union, to show them, and Stalin in particular, that we had the bomb, what it could do, and that the United States had the will to use this even against civilians.
Was this the rationale that was given to the U.S. public for the use of nuclear weapons?
Hardly. The rationale given to the U.S. people was that the bombs were needed to bring an end to the war in a way that would reduce the loss of U.S. soldiers' lives. In fact, this history was to have been presented to the U.S. people on the 50th anniversary of the atomic bombings, an exhibit at the Smithsonian Institute. It would have also indicated that, for example, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Leahy at the time, had been reporting to Truman that a surrender on terms acceptable to the United States could be arranged, you know, without the bombing, that General, then later President Eisenhower, was very clear that we didn't need to hit them with that awful thing. But because undermining the legitimacy of the first atomic bombings would have undermined, further undermined the legitimacy, or demonstrated the illegitimacy of the United States nuclear weapons program, the Air Force and very conservative members of Congress moved to kill that exhibit. And so this history, while widely known among scholars, didn't get to the U.S. people.
After the end of World War II, how did the United States justify expanding its nuclear arsenal?
Well, you know, the different sectors rationalize it in different ways. Eisenhower, President Eisenhower's rationale was that after the Great Depression of the 1930s and the dislocations of the Second World War, the United States needed to focus on economic development. And the cost of maintaining a massive ground force military to discipline the empire just didn't work well with economic demands. So he adopted a policy based on full retaliation with nuclear weapons. So during his administration, the United States threatened nuclear attacks against Vietnam, Soviet Union, Lebanon, Iraq, China, multiple threats.
Besides the threat of nuclear war, how has the U.S. governments, how have U.S. governments used their nuclear weapons to expand and maintain the U.S. empire?
Well, we know how it began there in the end of the Second World War. What you see, and one of the things I describe in the book, is how the overwhelming U.S. dominance so terrorized China and the Soviet Union in the first decades of the Cold War that they really bent and bowed to U.S. demands. So, for example, at the Geneva negotiations in 1954 over the future of Vietnam, both the Russians and the Chinese bowed to U.S. demands to move the dividing line between North and South Vietnam further north to the 17th parallel and to put off the date of the elections for reunification in a way that would allow the United States to consolidate its control over South Vietnam under a new president, Diem. You have the disciplining of the empire, especially in the Middle East, with the nuclear threats on more than 30 occasions. The United States won what the State Department described as one of the greatest strategic prizes in world history, Middle East oil, in 1945. And in order to maintain this prize of the empire, it's been the focus of more nuclear threats than any other area.
In the book, you talk about the madman approach to U.S. foreign policy. How has this approach been used?
Well, this was actually Nixon's term. This is not a term used to describe Nixon, but one that Nixon described himself. In 1968, maybe some of your listeners will remember, President Nixon campaigned for the presidency, saying that he had a secret plan to end the Vietnam War. And this was something that most of us at the time just thought was a flat-out lie. In fact, it was true. Haldeman, his chief of staff, has written about it. Nixon's written about it in his memoirs and others. The idea was something he had learned from Eisenhower during the Korean War. And what he said, what he told Haldeman was, look, what we'll do is we'll send a message to the Vietnamese that Nixon is just such a wild, mad anti-communist that we can't keep his fingers off the button in the launching of nuclear weapons. And Nixon said, well, when they hear this, they'll come to Paris and negotiate an end to the war on whatever terms we dictate. And then in the course of the summer of 1969, this threat was communicated to the Soviets and to the Vietnamese through the Soviet ambassador. Kissinger had meetings, communicated through the dictator of Romania, Ceausescu, and also through a French diplomat. And the Vietnamese didn't blink. Then come October, Nixon put U.S. forces on a full, the highest level of nuclear alert that went on for more than almost 30 days, about 27 days, with SAC bombers armed with nuclear weapons, lined up on air bases across the United States so the Soviets could photograph them with nuclear weapons in civilian airports to the point where the military was very scared that we'd have a nuclear accident in a major urban area here, and flying nuclear weapons up along the Russian border. But again, the Vietnamese didn't blink, and the messages that Nixon was getting from the Kissinger shop, although it wasn't from Kissinger, was that if the United States followed through on that threat, that they'd have to use as much force against the U.S. people to repress the protests that would come. And so it was Nixon who blinked in that case and backed off of his threat and did it in probably one of the two most important and successful speeches of his career. It's called the Silent Majority Speech, in which he committed to fight the war in Vietnam as long as it took. And this was a way of signaling to the Chinese and to the Russians that the United States was still a great power and not the paper tiger that Mao said we were.
More recently, in March 2002, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists moved the doomsday clock ahead to 7 minutes to midnight. Has nuclear war become more likely under the current U.S. administration?
Yes, well, both with that and then their more recent moving of the doomsday clock ahead to 5 minutes to midnight, with their warning, and what I say in the book, is that the possibility of a nuclear war has in fact increased. People should remember that at the end of the Cold War, the hands of the doomsday clock were pushed all the way back to 17 minutes before midnight. The concerns of the editors of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists were numerous. They were concerned about other nations obtaining nuclear weapons, about the threat of so-called loose nukes. They also included in that warning concerns about global warming. But again, their dominant concern was about Bush administration nuclear war policies. The Nuclear Posture Review, adopted by the Bush administration in 2002, talks about and pledges the United States to accelerate its development of new nuclear weapons and their deployment. Talks about accelerating preparations for resumption of nuclear weapons testing. Names seven countries as primary U.S. nuclear targets, and again reiterates the U.S. first strike policy. So you have this, if you will, embrace of the threat of nuclear terrorism, which in fact is the practice of nuclear terrorism.
Will things improve if the next U.S. president is a Democrat?
I would say marginally, but not deeper than that. I mean, the history is that every and of course it would depend on which Democrat, but the history is that every president since Truman, and Truman was a Democrat, has prepared and threatened to initiate nuclear war. We've had, under really popular pressure that I've been involved with here, related to the primaries and the campaign for winning the nomination, we've been able to get just about all of the leading Democratic contenders for the nomination to say that they're opposed to developing a new generation of nuclear weapons, which are misnamed reliable replacement warheads. This is a weapon system that the Bush administration is pressing. But at the same time, as we speak, the Bush administration has said that all options must be on the table in relationship to Iran, and we have a couple of nuclear-capable fleets just off the Iranian coast. And Senator Clinton, Senator Obama, former Senator Edwards have all reiterated that call. We've confronted them on this, but they're still holding to it.
In the book, you talk about the importance of working towards nuclear arms abolition rather than arms control. Is abolition a realistic goal?
I think it's quite a realistic goal, and most of the world's nations believe it is as well. There's a sense that for most of us who are alive, that nuclear weapons have been here since we were born, and so a temptation to look at them as sort of like the mountains and the ocean and the stars, that they're just part of the natural environment and part of the human condition. In fact, what we know is that just about every year in the General Assembly of the United Nations, the world's nations vote to demand that the nuclear powers fulfill their commitments under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. In Article 6, they pledge to negotiate the complete elimination of their nuclear arsenals, and the World Court has reiterated that this is what they must do. At the same time, you have the 2000 Nuclear Nonproliferation Review Conference, the nuclear powers were forced to reiterate their irrevocable commitment, that's their term, irrevocable commitment, to negotiate the elimination of the nuclear arsenals. And they agreed to what people understand are the 13 most important steps in that direction, beginning with the negotiation of a comprehensive test ban treaty that the United States still hasn't ratified, the next step being the negotiation of a fissile material cutoff treaty so that the materials for nuclear weapons are no longer produced and those that exist are inventoried and put under lock and key. But again, the United States at this point refuses to negotiate a verifiable cutoff treaty. Countries such as Malaysia, Costa Rica, international lawyers groups, and others have put forward a model treaty which moves through all these steps. So it's clear that the roadmap is understood. Amazingly, people such as Henry Kissinger, former Secretary of State Shultz, former commander of the U.S. Strategic Command, General Lee Butler, have all said that the U.S. nuclear arsenal is counterproductive and that it's time for us to finally implement our commitments to negotiate the elimination of these absolutely catastrophic weapons. I mean, just to break a little bit of the abstraction, people should remember that the Hiroshima A-bomb, which by today's standards was a small one, destroyed that entire city in 9 seconds. So we're talking about weapons that are really beyond the destructive imagination that almost anybody has.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and I hope people in your audience will do what they can to keep the pressure on so we can live more securely.
That was Dr. Joseph Gerson of the American Friends Service Committee in New England, author of the new book, Empire and the Bomb. He spoke to Karen McIntosh of Red Eye Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia. Before that, we heard an interview with community activist Malefi Ndlovu speaking to Sokari Akine of Pambazuka News about efforts to build a radical community radio station in Soweto, South Africa. We also had a weekly roundup of media news from John Anderson and Kimberly Cronick of Media Minutes. I'm Bronwyn Malden with the Los Angeles Independent Media Center. To hear all these audio pieces in full and to find links to all the resources you've heard about today, visit kpfk.org. Click on Programs, then choose Indie Media On Air. If you'd like to comment on this show, please drop me a line at radioimc@gmail.com. Please join us again next week and every Monday at 3 p.m. for Indie Media On Air on KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara.